Welcome to another episode of Foreign Domestic and Forbidden, the podcast about books and ideas. I'm Tim Trash.
I am Joaquin Lobo.
And we'll be your hosts for the next hour. So good to see you. Joaquin, how are you?
I'm good. I'm getting ready to go to Mexico City. I'm excited.
And I'm jealous yet again. You're traveling way more than I do. That's really cool. Very, very cool.
And also the good news is that our next episode is going to be recorded from Mexico City.
Yes. And, I'm excited. Sure
we will have a really good guest. I need to confirm, but I'm excited for the next episode.
Yeah, me too. That's awesome. Also, like, I think that's the first recording we do so from you and I in different countries. So that's cool.
Yeah. And I'm curious about this episode because it is not Valentine's Day yet. We don't give a shit and we're going to talk about love, right? Love and literature.
Yes, love and literature. You suggested it at some point several weeks back, and we didn't get around to doing it, and I brought it up again because I was really ticked off by this one comment. It's really a stupid reason to talk about love, but I was really ticked off by this one comment some person in favor of the recent Supreme Court ruling about abortion said that what the court decided was all about love. And I got so angry and so mad at the stupid person. And I was just really beside me, like, to say that it was about love, because children here don't get any love. There's no universal child care. There's no universal health care, you know? And I've lived in a town where there was an orphanage, a Baptist children's home, and it was horribly run, and it was really terrible. And so to say sort of this was about love, but that got me thinking that we should actually talk about love stories, the love stories we like, why we like them, what kinds of love we are attracted to, or we read, or we are curious about, all these things. So yeah, I'm super excited about it.
Have you written love stories, Tim?
Yes, I've in a very, very strange way, I think all my books are about love and have a somewhat central love story to them. It usually doesn't work out well.
No, it does. I mean, But I Don't Know You is a beautiful novel with the big love theme throughout the.
Yeah, but it's I think that is the biggest love story I ever put in a book. I mean, it's all about that. It is. But while the love these two people share is real, or was real at some point at least, it's also doomed in a certain way. I mean, I don't think for the reader, but for the two characters there.
Right. Well,
yeah. So, I mean, they do end up together, but they also don't end up together. And I'll leave it at that. But mm-hmm. it's not like a really happy ending. Everything is resolved and everybody gets what they want.
Yeah, but that's an unfair expectation that love stories should have a happy ending. I think that's very naive.
Yeah. Yeah. And The Tattoo Hunter, I mean, is a love story.
Yeah, and it's a very dark love story. I think that, of course, what people write, not just Joe and I, it's, of course, very influenced by what the lessons we learn from, the books we read, or the people who raised us, or friends. And in general, I have no issue acknowledging that what I knew about love as a child and as a young man was very fucked up. And I didn't have very good role models.
Yeah. I can agree with that wholeheartedly. So what do you think, what kind of love stories are you attracted to? If I said, oh, you should read this, this is a love story, what kind of story would you have in mind, Joaquin? Like what is it that you would want on the page? What kind of love story would you want to read?
Well, I gravitate to very dark, tragic love stories. Mm-hmm. And a proof of that is are a couple of the books that I chose to recommend, to discuss and for this session. One of them is a magnificent novel, one of my all-time favorite books, written by Graham Greene in the 50s, The End of the Affair.
Yes.
And that, I think this choice reveals a lot about me as a reader, because it's an incredibly dark, tragic book that has to do with jealousy. Great, powerful, overwhelming, destructive jealousy, and tragedy. The two characters in the, and this is an autobiographical novel. There is no secret about that.
Yeah,
Graham Greene wrote this book after a breakup with a lover, a married woman. That also tells you something about why this is so tragic. He fell in love with a woman. An American woman who was married to a very wealthy English aristocrat. She had four kids, Catherine Walston, really beautiful woman, who looked, according to Graham Greene, a lot like Laura Bacall. So they had this intense, obsessive, tragic love affair that lasted for about 10 years, and then everything ended, and then Graham Greene wrote the book. And, you know, there is this kind of interesting angle to the story, because it involves God and religion. Catherine Walston converted to Catholicism when she fell in love with Graham Greene. So it's a story about the love of God and the love of flesh.
Yeah.
And it doesn't end well.
Yes, it really does.
There are a couple film adaptations, one from the 1960s, I believe, and the other one probably the 1990s.
Yeah.
I think Neil Jordan directed the second one. And I like it. I think it's pretty good, even though it's not a very faithful adaptation of the book. I think it's pretty good. And the other novel that I chose, it's also very, very dark. Book from 1935, The Postman Always Rings Twice by James.
Oh, yes.
Which happens to be, you know, the mother of all crime novels in American fiction. It's just a classic. Also, yeah. A couple of film adaptations. The second one, pretty bad, with Jack Nicholson. And who is it? Ray Dunaway? No, it's just Jessica Lange.
Yeah, Jessica Lange, yeah.
But the first one is pretty good. And it's also super dark. It involves a murder, two lovers who fall for each other in a, you know, very carnal, intense way, and they decide to kill the husband. But, you know, these are very twisted ideas of love. And I think that's kind of what I have gravitated towards for most of my life, very dark, twisted love stories that no doubt reveals something about myself, you know, what I learned as a young man with a very deficient sentimental education. But I don't mind it. I you know, I'm not ashamed. I'm not saying, oh my God, this is so bad. No, don't do it for me.
Yeah.
You know, listening to,
yeah,
to misogynistic Mexican boleros and songs from the 1940s and 50s when I was a kid and growing up with, you know, surrounded by men who drank to drown their sorrows, you know, the cliche of the wounded macho, all of that of course I saw as a kid and influenced my taste in books and, you know, my own behavior in life until I realized it didn't work and I had to implement big changes, fortunately.
Yeah. When I grew up, I think I had a hard time imagining that anybody could fall in love with me and actually stay in love with me. I think the staying in love was always much more mysterious to me than the falling in love, because we can fall in love with pretty much anything all the time, and we do. But staying in love with someone or something seemed always a much, much bigger task, a monumental task. And I think I was always afraid, maybe I'm still afraid, that people will find out that, oh my God, there's nothing to you, Tim. There is no person there. You know, that someone would fall in love and then realize very quickly that, yeah, that was all good and fine, but that has no future. I don't want to stay. There's not enough there. And I think that stayed with me for a really long time, this fear of being loved and submitting to this and fulfilling expectations. And I think that's why growing up, I was really attracted to books where people know that their relationship will be for a limited time only. And I was very drawn to that. I wrote once a short story about two people protesting the first Iraq war in the 90s. And they are in Berlin, and there's a big protest in one of the main squares in West Berlin. I mean, it was not really the West anymore, but still, it was still the West Berlin. And so they're part of a large group of people who are protesting, and they're camping out there on that square. And the guy who has been going down there because he's in a rut, he doesn't know what to do, and he submits to this protest as a protest not only against the Iraq war, but against life as he's living it. And he meets a woman, and they know they're not in love, like horribly in love and eternally in love with each other. But for the time they are protesting, they stay together and have this perfect relationship of mutual respect, love, lust, all these, because it doesn't have to last at all. And so my first recommendation, the book I want to talk about, is Balcony in the Forest by the French writer Julien Gracq.
I don't know. First time I hear about it.
Yeah, it's not widely known. A friend and colleague of mine turned me on to it. It was published, republished by the New York Review Books imprint. And there's something like that really appealed to me, and appealed to me in the sense that it's a doomed relationship, but these people are okay with it, because it chronicles the last weeks in the life of a French lieutenant in the Second World War, Lieutenant Grange, and in the village that he's supposed to defend, there's a bunker nearby where he and his troops live. In that village, he meets a young widow, and they don't make any. It's clear, like there's no declaring of love or like any courtship. They meet each other, they're attracted to one another, and for a few weeks, they just enjoy being in the company of each other. And to me, it makes it very memorable, because you're going into this relationship fully aware that none of it will last. You are not the one person for each other. And that lets you enjoy everything and take advantage of everything in a...
I have to read that.
Yeah, it's not, the book isn't even really about that relationship. Mm. It's more about him being in this dream-like state of anticipating the German advance, but it's not coming yet. But still, there's this perfect devotion to each other because they know it won't last. So they don't have to think about retirement and eternal love and none of that. And that makes it very beautiful, and they relate to each other in such very normal, unstilted, egotistical in a good sense way. And yeah, it's a beautiful, very underplayed love story.
I love how these conversations take us to very unexpected places, because as you were talking about Berlin and then this novel, I thought of one of my, probably my all-time favorite love story in film, which is Wings of Desire, 1997 film by Wim Wenders.
Yeah.
And I remember watching that in 1987. And at the time, I was in love with someone who recommended that film. And it completely blew me away. And I immediately thought of it as a film that really captured the spirit of that generation. You know, when I was a young man, 25-year-old man, who saw in disbelief how an angel would want to become a human because he fell in love with a woman, right? And I'm sure you know the film. I don't know if you like it, but to me, that was such a beautiful, magical, intense experience at the time.
I never watched it.
Oh, God.
I was in my anti Wim Wenders phase, and everybody was just so in love with the movie and so overhyping it. It was the English Patient syndrome. I did actually watch The English Patient, but it became sort of this thing like that everybody loved, and I couldn't bear that.
That's interesting. To me, it was completely exotic coming from Mexico City. But of course, were you in Berlin at the time?
Yeah.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
It makes sense that you would rebel against that.
Yeah, I think not. I'm curious enough now that I actually really want to watch it, because now I can watch it, and Bruno Ganz is in it, and he has the strangest voice of any movie actor I know, and
I like him a lot.
Yeah, very beautiful, and so now I actually want to watch it.
I think you should give it a chance, because I watch it a bunch of times, and it never disappoints me. It's just beautiful.
Yeah.
Just please never watch the stupid American adaptation with Nicolas Cage. Give me a fucking break.
Oh, yeah. There was one. That's true.
I think it's called City of Angels or something like that. Please don't watch it. I don't know why they do that.
Oh, yeah. That's a weird one to remake. That doesn't make any sense
whatsoever. Why would you in LA?
Yeah.
Nicolas Cage was, you know, kidding that. He's not an angel.
But you have to admire the guts, you know, just to remake it and think that that's going to work. It takes a certain mindset. It's kind of admirable. I mean, doomed, but admirable. Speaking of doomed and admirable, I think the first book I thought about when we decided to have this topic was Jeanette Winterson's The Passion.
Right. Yeah.
From 1987.
I love that book.
Oh, it's one of my five favorite books, I think.
I know you mentioned it before.
Exactly.
It's just
so crazy. I mean, you have these two main characters, Henri and Villanelle. Henri at some point falls in love with Villanelle, but she doesn't fall in love with him. She is in love with a woman in Venice. She is from Venice herself. She calls the Queen of Spades, and that is doomed, and Henri's love is doomed, and yet the moments they share together, and the description of the individual love relationships is so beautiful. It's just stunning. And there is some magic realism. I don't know if you want to really call that. I mean, it's almost like they have fairy tale aspects in there. That are still super
magical realism.
Super stunning. And right. I just love it. And to me, when I was first reading it, that was probably in the 90s.
That's when I read it.
Yeah. And it to me, like, the language is so terse and clipped, like in a fairy tale or like in modern fiction, sort of 1920s or so. But then it dips really deep into fairy tale territory, so that the historical novel aspect of it almost gets lost. History becomes kind of a fairy tale. And yeah, still stunning whenever I read it. I teach it a lot. I'm still just bowled over by the book. It hasn't lost anything. I can still read it the same way with the same sense of wonder and rediscover it. Yeah.
I'm glad you're teaching. I used to teach it many, many years ago, but I kind of forgot about it. You brought Janet Winterson back into my life. Also, the other, Tim, the other book that you reminded me of when you said French Lieutenant a while ago was, of course, The French Lieutenant Woman by Joan Fowles, which is a really amazing, such an amazing, amazing writer, Joan Fowles, really great novel. From the 1960s, to recall, that was adapted into a film.
Yeah.
I remember the film, the woman was Meryl Streep, I believe. And I don't really remember a lot about the film, but the book is just amazing. You know, one of those impossible, strange love stories that made a huge impact in me when I read it many, many years ago. I should read that. So I really appreciate John Fowles' incredibly careful, dense, intense prose. Remember, I don't know if you read The Collector, which is another novel that was adapted into a film by John Fowles.
I have not read that one.
Which was also adapted into a very successful film, probably back in the 60s or 70s, kind of a scary film, very dark, definitely not a love story, very sinister.
Cool. Sounds very good.
Yeah.
So my next pick is I don't think you can really call it a love story. It's a short story by Stephanie Vaughan. She has really only written one book of short stories, but it's really an amazing book. And it is called Sweet Talk.
Mm.
It came out in the 90s, and it came just recently.
Is that on your sign?
I have no idea what just happened. That's I don't know. Maybe he's getting his boat ready. That was very weird. So Stephanie Vaughan, she has the short story collection, Sweet Talk. It came out in the 90s, and recently a Kindle came out, so you can get it again. The hardcover and paperback are out of print, but you can still get them used.
Good.
And the story that I want to focus on is called Dog Heaven, and I saw it first in an anthology. And yeah, you can't really call it a love story, but it's about two young boys at an army base near Niagara Falls. It's told by one of the boys from years later. And the whole story starts with a sentence: every so often that dad dog dreams me up again. And these two boys, Sparky and the narrator, and the dog, whose name is Duke, are this trio and defend each other against bullies, against being lonely on the army base. And it's a love story in the sense that there's no like erotic relationship or any of that, but they're entirely devoted to each other. And really, like, it's a love, like, I don't want to call it innocence because I don't believe in innocence. I think even as a young child, I was guilty as hell. So I don't believe in this whole concept that young children are innocent, but it's a love that is not yet diluted with thoughts about career, making a living, living forever, or any of that. But it's a friendship born a little bit out of necessity, but also because they see each other as equals. And the dog is in the story almost the catalyst for everything, and making sure that these things really happen. It's sort of the connector to the past and to that age when other concerns about life, about a job, about a career, about family and all that, when those thoughts had not yet entered. It's a very nostalgic story.
Is it written from the point of view of the kids?
Of the kid, yeah, of the one kid. I don't think he ever gets to have a name.
Yeah, that's tricky.
And
I admire that. It's very difficult.
Yeah, and to write back into that time and to try to reconnect to a time that was not easy for either of the boys. But there was a purity of devotion between them. And
you see, I like that devotion, but not love, maybe.
Yeah.
Because when we talk about love, it's just like, to me, such a waste of time to talk about love or to talk about happiness, because to me, they don't mean anything. Devotion, I mean, love and happiness just sounds so empty and misused and misappropriated and confused. And they're just, you know, kind of designed to create misunderstanding and to confuse us.
Yeah. And in that sense, the dog is probably the ideal character in the story because he is devoted. He has a mind of his own. He runs off. He does all kinds of weird things. But he shows, I think, the boy something of being in the moment, of being there, of holding them together. And so the sentence of that the dog is dreaming the narrator up again, that he exists most perfectly in the memory of this dead dog, I'm in love with that concept. Which I like really also because we live in other people, but often I'm really afraid to think of that. So what other people might think, and I can get very obsessed about that. But certain beings, certain people only are with us for a year, 6 months, 5 years, whatever. And I sometimes wonder what is in those minds of those people, if we exist at all in their minds, like or what kind of space we occupy. And so here, the dog's story, though it's never told like from the point of view of the dog, which would be horrible, but the dog owns the best version of the narrator.
Maybe that's why people go on Facebook to find their old classmates to see if they were really alive 30 years ago in their eyes.
Yeah, yeah. People know these stories. People have certain images about people they once knew, and it's very strange. I'm not sure how I feel about that. Sometimes I wish I could hit sort of a button like the Men in Black and everybody would forget about me. It seems like a very clean solution. So.
Well, the people will forget about us eventually. But, you know, maybe that's why people write books. I don't know, you know, people like you and I maybe write books because, you know, somehow we want to be remembered, or we want for people to remember the things that we saw. Some people say that, you know, we write books because we're writing love letters to the people we hold dear, and the people we remember. With people, I used to say that I wrote books because they were letters to my dead, to the people who have died, and I somehow want to still communicate with them. Some other people write books to the people that they love, and that I think that's really beautiful and generous and kind.
Yeah, and it's to me, the books I write, I think, are also helping me to remember things that occurred. I mean, they're really sort of little portals into my memory. You know how we can access our memories sort of by music, by things we read, by the knickknacks we collected, by all kinds of things, but the books really hold a certain, they're little memory palaces, and you can enter them and so in a weird sense, they're love letters to other people, but they're also allowing the author to love people again and find a way back to the love they felt for other people.
Let me share with you this poem by E. E. Cummings, which I think sort of what you were saying. I think this is what E. E. Cummings is actually doing, this really gorgeous love poem. And this poem, it's been part of my life for so many years, that when I go back to it, I immediately go back to those moments where I suffer and love with this kind of intensity, the intensity with which E. E. Cummings wrote this poem. And it's a very well-known poem by E. E. Cummings. So this is, you know, very cliche, I apologize, but I happen to love these five stanzas. In a very special way. Somewhere I have never traveled, gladly beyond any experience, your eyes have their silence. In your most frail gesture are things which enclose me, or which I cannot touch because they are too near. Your slightest look easily will enclose me, though I have closed myself as fingers. You open always petal by petal myself as spring opens, touching skillfully, mysteriously, her first rose. But if you wish to be close, to close me, I and my life will show very beautifully, suddenly, as when the heart of this flower imagines the snow carefully everywhere descending. Nothing which we are to perceive in this world equals the power of your intense fragility, whose texture compels me with the color of its countries, rendering death and forever with each breathing. I do not know what it is about you that closes and opens. Only something in me understands the voice of your eyes is deeper than all roses. Nobody, not even the rain, has such small hands. And that's probably the corniest poem that, you know, anyone could even share, but to me that is still tells me something that's so precious about loving someone.
Isn't Michael Caine reciting that in one of Woody Allen's movies? maybe Hannah and her sisters.
Oh, wow. Maybe.
Yeah, I think the last line of
that's
it,
a good film. I first
heard in a Woody Allen movie.
It's a very famous poem. I think that's why it probably comes across as corny, but I don't care.
Yeah.
I don't mind that Michael Caine or, you know, it's reciting it because Woody Allen wants him to in that pretty good film. But there is something about the way in which poetry can, express things that novelists have a hard time trying to convey in longer, much longer bodies of work.
Yeah, I think poetry is much more direct and can express conflicting emotions and confused emotions way better than any narrative can.
I agree.
It's funny too, sometimes I listen to songs and they tell a love story and I might be moved by that, and then I look at the lyrics later and they don't make any sense. But I mean, they're not beautiful in the sense that they're really connecting well or that they tell a cohesive story, but they're sort of, they're pointing the finger, the metaphorical finger at certain things. They just sort of like hit the little bell and you hear the chime and other things fall into place. And it's harder to do that in a short story or a novel. With poetry, there's so much less connective tissue you need. You can cut away the flap and poetry
or with
is...
With song, Tim. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you have your favorite love song or love songs.
When I was 12 or 13, I thought REO Speedwagon's Keep On Loving You was a really beautiful song. And then just maybe 8-9 years ago, I met a singer-songwriter in a small town in New Mexico, and he told me actually what the lyrics were about, and then I looked up the lyrics and they're so super creepy and weird. It's not really a love song at all. It's something else entirely. It's really scary and creepy and all that. So that went off my list. But yes, they're beautiful love songs.
I never heard that song, but I remember when I was a kid, like I said, I come from a different kind of, there was a singer from Spain, Joan Manuel Serrat, and I just fell in love to his songs, and there were so many of them that I remember, you know, being 10, 11, 12 years old, I mean, completely in love listening to these gorgeous poems, because he was, you know, he's still alive, he's a poet. And that's, you know, what Bob Dylan and so many other people did for many generations.
Yeah.
Of singing poems that you could fall in love to.
One more book that I have mentioned before, but never really talked about, I think, and that's The Black Book by Orhan Pamuk.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned Orhan Pamuk several times, still one of my favorite writers. And The Black Book chronicles one guy's search for the wife who has left him unexpectedly without any announcement. And he's searching for her in Istanbul. He thinks he's a lawyer. His name is Galip. And he thinks his wife, Ruya, has run away with her half-brother, Jalal, who is a columnist for a newspaper. And he writes these columns about Istanbul. He's basically a chronicler of Istanbul. And so he travels through Istanbul, meets all kinds of people on the way to at least trying to find his wife. And it's a heartbreaking book, and it's interspersed with these columns by Jalal, which he then later on in the book starts writing himself. And so he's kind of becoming this other person. And so it's not only a love letter to the missing wife, it's also a love letter to Istanbul and to writing and what you can accomplish with writing and how you can change life with writing. Yeah, it's a very sad book. But very, very beautiful. And we never much see the wife, but she nevertheless becomes alive in the narrator's imagination, and it's one of the saddest relationships ever. Very strange, very truncated, and very, very beautiful. So yeah, that's my last pick. Orhan Pamuk.
Have you been to Istanbul, Tim?
Hmm?
Have you traveled to Istanbul?
I have not. I really wanted to, always wanted to, and I've never been able to. Have you been?
No, but I want to.
Yeah.
And maybe, you know, I will just jump on a plane and go to Istanbul at some point, because it's one of those places that I really would love to see. And Orhan Pamuk has a lot to do with that, because I mean, the way he sees Istanbul, it's so unique and rich and beautiful that it just, you know, makes you. I remember you love Paul Auster. I think that people have decided to go to New York City because of Paul Auster, and yeah. I'm one of those people who would go to Istanbul because of Orhan Pamuk.
Yeah, and I went to London once for Peter Aykroyd. So there's this odd literary travel that you read something by an author and you really want to see what it is about. Yeah.
How many people, you know, want to go to Colombia because of García Márquez, or to Buenos Aires because of Borges and Cortázar? It just makes sense.
Yeah. The strangest thing once was when I lived in New Mexico, not many people actually knew what New Mexico was. It's really hard, like, to imagine sometimes, but there was a column in the New Mexico magazine of these little misunderstandings when people say, I'm from New Mexico. People would say, oh, so you must speak Spanish. And people would say, no, I'm from New Mexico. I'm not from Mexico. And people mistake it, like certain companies would say, oh, we need to charge you for international delivery.
Are you kidding me? Jesus Christ.
No, really, really true. And so I had always a hard time when I said, like, where I was living. People didn't know the town. They asked me weird questions about New Mexico. But once I was coming back from Los Angeles and flew into Albuquerque, mm-hmm. And there was this couple from Australia, and they were going to Albuquerque because of Breaking Bad. Breaking Bad put New Mexico on the map for international people from all over the world, and they were coming just because of Walter White. They wanted to see.
There is a break. But just like, you know, like I went to Stockholm, and you can't help but think of the girl with the dragon tattoo.
Oh, you know? yes.
Yeah, and there's this, this is probably not as well known, but I ended up going to, and that takes me to a poem that I wanted to share with you. I went to the house of Pablo Neruda in Chile, to Isla Negra, which is not an island, it's not a black island. Isla Negra is just the name of the house where that Pablo Neruda built, and where he lived, in long, long time ago. And just seeing those places that you have somehow seen built inside of yourself in your mind as a reader, right? The Istanbul of the mind, the Coney Island of the mind, you know,
yeah.
Lawrence Ferlinghetti's poem, the London of the mind, the Albuquerque of the mind, of the imagination, because you created these places based on your ability to imagine and to build and to recreate in your own personal vision, right? Based on your longings and desires. That's quite an interesting experience.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And of course, when I went to Isla Negra, I was very disappointed. It was like, you know, as it happens in many other places that I have visited, that I end up being very disappointed because the reality never matches the fiction that you create. I will be disappointed when I go to Istanbul. It's going to look like probably like a shitty, you know, Mexican yeah. city, something like that. But still, I wanted to share Pablo Neruda's at least one of his poems because
yes.
that's the man who wrote the 20 poems of love and a song of despair. That was a very important part of my sentimental education as a very young man. What's interesting about Neruda is, of course, that he sort of invented his own brand of surrealism while French surrealism was taking place in Europe. Neruda, in his Chilean solitude, came up with, you know, very, very interesting poems that were surrealist without Neruda knowing anything about surrealism, in an interesting case of simultaneous imagination across the ocean. This brand of surrealism is, of course, a very direct result of romanticism. So I grew up, you know, with this version, very masculine idea of a female body, the sublimation of the female that is so dated these days and that nobody buys. I remember, you know, many years ago telling my students, so, you know, when you fall in love, you have to get yourself a copy of this book, The 20 Poems of Love and a Song of Despair.
Yeah.
And go into a bedroom and don't leave that bedroom, you know, drink a bottle of wine and read these poems to each other and make love to each other, you know, for days as you sort of dive into the experience of these poems. Now I look at them and I read them and, you know, they're just looks, yes, they're beautiful. But they're so, I'm not going to say problematic, but they're just so old and dated. And I don't know if Neruda is canceled because everyone gets canceled at some point. I don't know if right now he's been canceled. But just the, you know, the first two stanzas of this poem called Body of a Woman. Body of a woman, white heels, white thighs. You look like a worm lying in surrender. My rough peasant's body digs in you and makes the sun leap from the depth of the earth. I was alone like a tunnel. The birds fled from me and night swam me with its crushing invasion. To survive myself, I forged you like a weapon, like an arrow in my bow, a stone in my sling. But the hour of vengeance falls and I love you, body of a skin, of moss, of eager and firm milk. Oh, the goblets of the breast, oh, the eyes of absence, oh, the roses of the pubis, oh, your voice is low and sad. Body of a woman, I will persist in your grace, my thirst, my boundless desire, my shifting road, dark river beds where the eternal thirst flows and weariness follows and the infinite ache.
Wow.
100 years later, you know, this is like, we don't love like this. Well, maybe we do, maybe we don't, but, you know, we don't express yeah. our love like this.
Yeah.
We become too, I don't know, skeptical, cynical, jaded, to put so much love and, you know, to depend so much on these images to convey what we feel.
Yeah, I often feel we love in the cracks. We don't go at it directly, but we show affection sort of in unobserved moments or when our facades crack a little bit. But we don't go at this full-throated love really anymore. Maybe in romance novels, but this unadulterated obsession with love and lust and everything in between there. I don't think we can do it anymore without irony.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Without irony.
Yeah. So we can say that, but then we have to do a wink, wink, and then it's okay, maybe. But
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you need to explain it. You need to contextualize it.
Yeah.
So people won't freak out and put a restraining order against you.
Restraining order is the word. We need to come to our recommendations. It's already the time.
Oh, wow.
I know. We haven't even covered the order of love, but
anyway. I know. I'm hesitant to recommend this book, but you know, maybe I will. It's Octavio Paz, A Tree Within. It's a good book. I think that, I mean, I've been recommending books for like the past hour, so what do I recommend? Maybe I should recommend something else. Yes, I'm going to recommend a show that I just finished watching the first season. It's a very new show, and it's not the kind of show that I watch. It's called The Bear.
Hmm.
And it's about a chef in Chicago. And it's just, it was quite a surprise. I really, really enjoyed it. I watched the first 8 episodes of the first season, and you can watch it on Hulu. But it's really good in a strange way. And I, in particular, like the female characters. The guys are kind of predictable, you know, tough, macho, but sensitive guys that I know very well. But the female character, it's a young Black woman who is just absolutely amazing. She's really something. So watch it because of her. The other guys are, you know, like I said, predictable, but this character, this female character is amazing.
Wow.
Yes, cool. Octavio Paz. Let's watch a good TV show.
Sounds great. I will recommend an old movie from 1966, Good Year for Movies. And just like last week, David Hemmings is in it again. But also David Niven and Donald Pleasence and Sharon Tate are all in that movie, and it's called Eye of the Devil. It's set in France, and it's a bit of a horror movie. In my mind, I link it a little bit to Shirley Jackson kind of horror.
Mm.
But it takes it a little farther in the movie. It's based on a novel. I haven't read the novel, Day of the Arrow by Robin Estridge. But I still remembered the movie very well. And recently I rewatched it. And it's awesome. I mean, it's a horror I don't think we necessarily respond to in the way we might respond to The Ring, let's say. But
right.
It's so beautifully stark and, I don't know, otherworldly. I don't have really a better word for that. It's really otherworldly, and I love it. Like how something that looks very idyllic, very pastoral and beautiful suddenly becomes the opposite of that. Really beautiful movie, The Eye of the Devil. No, I mean, just Eye of the Devil. No, The Eye of the Devil.
I'm going to watch it, but I also want to mention that Deborah Kerr, it's the
yes.
lead actor. She's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great. She's just amazing.
Yes.
Great recommendation, Tim. I'll check it out. I haven't watched it, but I will.
Yeah. So, and I'll check out the show you recommended. That sounds good.
Yeah. Well, I'll be curious to hear what you think of it.
Yeah. Well, all the best. Safe travels. We'll talk again when you are in Mexico City.
Yeah.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. And This was Foreign Domestic and Forbidden, and the music is by Springtide. It's their Coney Island Train Blues, and it comes to us via the Free Music Archive. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.